is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is All About Pets. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from New York Times, USAtoday.com, and Cornell Dog Watch. On today's program, we'll begin with an article from the New York Times titled, Are We Loving Our Pets to Death? By Linda Baker. Pet owners are treating their animal charges ever more like humans. But that isn't good for pets, or for us. Many experts agree. Pets are more popular than ever. Roughly two-thirds of American homes have at least one pet, up from 56% in 1988, according to the American Pet Products Association. And Americans spent $136.8 billion on their pets in 2022, up from $123.6 billion in 2021. An estimated 91 million households in Europe own at least one pet, an increase of over 20 million over the past decade. The pet population in India hit 31 million in 2021, up from 10 million in 2011. And our pets are becoming ever more like us, or at least that seems to be our goal. We pamper them with customized nutrition plans and knapsack carriers, dog hydrotherapy, and stays in boutique cat hotels. At All the Best, the high-end pet store chain in Seattle, the most popular items are feline and canine enrichment toys, designed to stimulate them and bring happiness to animals that increasingly are lying around alone and bored, said Annie McCall, the chain's marketing director. Now, somewhere, animal welfare ethicists and veterinary scientists are wondering if, in our efforts to humanize our pets, we've gone too far. The more we treat pets like people, they argue, the more constrained and dependent on us our pets' lives have become, and the more health and behavioral issues our pets develop. We now view pets not only as family members, but as equivalent to children, says James Serple, an emeritus professor of ethics and animal welfare at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. The problem is, dogs and cats are not children, and owners have become increasingly protective and restrictive. Some animals are not able to express their own doggy and catty natures as freely as they might. And the health risks begin with breeding, of course. One of the most popular dog breeds in the United States is the French Bulldog, a member of the brachycephalic family of flat-faced dogs that bond well with people who have trouble breathing, among other severe health problems. But we are also changing our animals' relationship to their surroundings. Out of concerns about bird predation, many cats now spend their entire lives inside. Until the late 1970s, even city dogs spent most of their time outdoors, either in backyards or roaming unleashed around the neighborhood. Now, said Jessica Pierce, a bioethicist in Colorado whose work focuses on animal-human relationships. The unleashed and loose dog is considered against the natural order of things. One of the fastest-growing market segments is the so-called pet confinement sector, which includes crates and indoor fencing, as well as head harnesses and electric collars. The level of constraint that dogs face is profound, Dr. Pierce said. Although dogs several decades ago were more likely to be hit by cars, she added, those risks were outweighed by the freedom of experience and movement. The modern pet paradox in a nutshell, owners don't want dogs to act like dogs, Dr. Serpell says. While dogs are allowed an ever-increasing number of human spaces, restaurants, offices, stores, hotels, as well as more parks with designated dog runs, their growing presence has not translated into greater independence. The confinement and isolation, in turn, have bred an increase in animal separation anxiety and aggression, Dr. Serpell says. Roughly 60% of cats and dogs are now overweight or obese, and due in part to the burden and expense of modern pet ownership, veterinary fees, pet sitters, boarding costs, more people are abandoning animals to animal shelters, leading to higher rates of euthanasia. In 2023, more than 359,000 dogs were euthanized in shelters, a five-year high according to Shelter Animals Count, an animal advocacy group. We're at an odd moment of obsession with pets, Dr. Pierce said. There are too many of them, and we keep them too intensively. It's not good for us, and it's not good for them. Granted, taming an animal has always meant striking a balance between its nature and ours. Defining freedom to a dog, an animal that has been domesticated artificially and selected by humans for so long, is a really interesting puzzle, says Alexander Horowitz, a canine cognition researcher at Barnard College. She drew a contrast with free-ranging dog, a category to which most of the world's estimated 900 million dogs belong. Free-roaming canines lead shorter lives and have no guarantee of food, Dr. Horowitz noted, but they do get to make all of their own choices. That is an interesting model for us to look at, thinking about how to make a dog's life more rich with choices so they are not just captive to our caprices all the time, while not endangering society at large. In recent years, Scandinavian countries have started to ban the breeding of some dog breeds that are particularly prone to disease, such as the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. In Sweden, it is illegal to leave pets alone at home for extended periods of time. In both Sweden and Finland, crating animals in the home is illegal in most cases. But whether these animal welfare policies reconcile or reinforce the fundamental paradox of modern pet keeping is unclear, says Harold Herzog, an emeritus psychology professor at Western Carolina University who studies animal-human relations. The more we view dogs and cats as autonomous creatures, the less we can justify owning them as pets, he said. A few years ago, Dr. Herzog vacationed on the island of Tobago and spent much of the time watching the stray dogs that roamed the landscape. I asked myself, would I rather live in Manhattan as a pampered dog, or would I rather be a dog in Tobago hanging out with my friends? Dr. Herzog said. He concluded, I'd rather be a dog in Tobago. That's not a practical option for most people, or necessarily good for the Tobagos of the world. Instead, for the modern pet owner, Dr. Serpell offers this advice. By all means, enjoy your dog's companionship. But dogs are not people. Get to know the animal from its own perspective instead of forcing to comply with yours. It enables you to vicariously experience the life of another being. Next, we'll move on to another article from the New York Times titled The Pet Superheroes Who Donate Their Blood by Emily Anthes. Transfusions have become an important part of veterinary medicine, but cat and dog blood is not always easy to come by. At first, it was hard to tell whether something was really wrong with Rover. The 10-year-old yellow lab had always been a bit of a loafer, so when he refused to get up from the rug last February, it was not entirely out of character, but then he declined a treat. That was when we were like, we have a very sick dog on our hands, says Hillary O'Halloran of Portland, Oregon. Ms. O'Halloran's husband rushed Rover to Dove Lewis Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, where doctors had grave news. The dog had a tumor on its spleen. Worse, it had ruptured, causing massive internal bleeding. Without a blood transfusion, Rover had just hours to live. The couple quickly gave their consent, and the transfusion brought enough time for further diagnostic testing. The veterinarians discovered that although Rover had an aggressive form of cancer, which would eventually recur, it had not yet metastasized. So they removed Rover's spleen and sent him home to live out his final months with his family. We're really just so grateful that there was even the option of having the transfusion, Miss O'Halloran said. We're just trying to make every day the best for him. All kinds of ailments, including injuries, infectious diseases, immune conditions, and cancer, can leave a pet in desperate need of blood, and transfusion has become an increasingly routine part of veterinary care. It's just as important part of veterinary medicine as it is for human medicine. This is Dr. Dana Levine, a small animal internist at Auburn University, and the president of the Association of Veterinary Hematology and Transfusion Medicine. But animal blood transfusions require animal blood, which is not always easy to come by. There is no canine red cross. Instead, there are hospitals with in-house blood donation colonies, veterinary clinics with a roster of ad hoc donors on call, and a number of commercial blood banks with wait lists that can stretch for months. There's also a growing community of pet owners who are signing their animals up to provide blood for other pets in need, which is how Dove Lewis found the blood gave to Rover. That some pet family said, yes, we want to do this, just really struck me as a very precious and generous gift, Ms. O'Halloran said. A bloody beginning. Transfusion medicine may have begun with dogs. The first well-documented successful transfusion in history took place in 1665 when a British physician used the blood of a healthy dog to revive a dying one. It was a grisly procedure and not one that was intended to benefit the canine recipient who had been deliberately bled for the experiment. Not until the mid-20th century did transfusions become a practical treatment option for sick pets. In those early decades, it tended to be ad hoc practice, with veterinarians sometimes turning to their own pets or animals that lived at their clinics when blood was needed. That approach hasn't entirely disappeared. There's a lot of folks that have a cat wandering their hospital who's an in-house donor, says Dr. Carl Jandry, an emergency and critical care veterinarian at the University of California, Davis. Cats and dogs have their own sets of blood types, so places that rely on in-house donors, which tend to be practices that do not often perform transfusions, must ensure the recipients are compatible with them. Commercial blood banks for animals began emerging in the 1980s. Some rely on closed colonies, a group of cats or dogs that live on site, providing blood for several years before they are put up for adoption. Closed colonies have been a critical source of animal blood and can be run humanely, experts said. I know many places that have fabulous cat rooms for cat donors, says Dr. Levine, who adopted her previous cat, Salt, from a blood donation colony. But animal rights activists are also exposed to mistreatment and abuse at some commercial blood banks with closed colonies, and demand far outstrips the volume of blood they can provide. Community canines. These factors have helped fuel interest in an alternate model, which recruits local pets to become regular donors. At Dove Lewis, roughly 90 dogs and 40 cats serve as regular donors, or what the hospital calls superheroes. And when Rover was discharged, Dove Lewis sent him home with one of a custom superhero trading cards featuring a photo of his donor, Kira, another lab who loved food and tennis balls. Community blood banks don't pay pet owners for blood, but they do offer perks, which often include free veterinary exams, blood work, and flea and tick preventatives. Animals are rewarded, too. At Dove Lewis, donor dogs get a jar of chicken or beef baby food. It's just the perfect size jar of smelly meat, says Kelsey Renauer, the blood bank director. And they get to pick a toy from our toy basket. After Rover was discharged, Miss O'Halloran returned to Dove Lewis with several bags full of new dog toys for the hospital's canine donors. And I made sure I had a can of tennis balls in there for Kira. The exact requirements for donating vary by program, but donors typically need to be completely healthy, relatively young, and big enough to spare some blood. Dogs typically donate about a pint at a time, while cats give less than 2 ounces. There's no specific breed we're looking for, says Dr. Valerie Latchford, the veterinarian and phlebotomist at Blue Ridge Veterinary Blood Bank, a commercial blood bank in Virginia that relies entirely on donations from pet dogs. We have everything from dogs that were picked up in shelters, a few of them in other countries, all the way up to like the top-winning Saponi, a shaggy Italian breed of all-time show dogs, service dogs. One non-negotiable. The dogs must seem comfortable with the staff in the process, able to remain relaxed for roughly 5 minutes it requires to draw their blood. They didn't sign the forms to come in, Dr. Latchford said, but they do get to have an option on whether they donate or not. The dog owner, Beth Acker, has seen that firsthand. Her former dog, Harley, a Bernese Mountain Dog, who craved food and attention, spent 6 years as a Blue Ridge donor. To have his blood drawn, Harley lay on his side on the table, spooning with the blood bank's designated dog snuggler, while being fed hand-fed cheese and peanut butter. He loved it immediately, Mrs. Acker said. I was really proud of him. Harley ultimately donated nearly 4 gallons of his blood. In the final years of his life, Harley needed a transfusion himself, bringing the experience full circle. On the other hand, Miss Acker's Coonhound Black Lab mix, Poncho, did not seem comfortable giving blood himself, though he tagged along on Harley's appointments to share the awesome treats, Miss Acker said. 9 lives. Cats tend to make for trickier donors. They'd all just jump on the table and lay down, says Miss Renauer of Dove Lewis. Feline blood donations often require sedation, which is not a risk-free procedure. For that reason, Dove Lewis only uses cats owned by people who work in the veterinary practice. Miss Renauer's cat Apollo, a sturdy Maine Coon, is a donor. There are places making community cat donation work, including Blue Pearl Pet Hospital, a chain of more than 100 veterinary hospitals. But its total donor pool includes about 250 cats compared with some 600 dogs. The donor pool is not large enough for either species, says Dr. Megan Respis, the National Director of Blood Banking. Blue Pearl would need to triple that number for donors in order to provide enough blood for all the hospitals, she said. Feline blood can be difficult to obtain, and type B cat blood is an especially precious commodity. This is Dr. Jandry of the University of California, Davis. Across the United States, fewer than 5% of cats have type blood B, he said. Dr. Megan Andier, the co-owner of City Cat Vets in Philadelphia, has a type B cat named Everett. He needed emergency surgery for a gallbladder obstruction this spring, but the hospital didn't have enough B blood. So Dr. Andier and her colleagues hit the phones, spending several hours calling hospitals and blood banks up and down the East Coast and eventually beyond. Without success, Dr. Andier took her daughter out of school so she could see Everett in case he didn't make it. With options running out, Dr. Andier called a client whose cat had type B blood. The cat, a black British Shorthair named Bagheera, was at the clinic in less than half an hour. Bagheera was well compensated with food and credit for her health care, Dr. Andier said. Today, Everett, who did end up needing Bagheera's blood, is back to his goofy, mellow self. And City Cat Vets is trying to build a roster of type B cats that they can call on for other animals in the future. Most pet owners would not be able to draw on the resources she had, said Dr. Andier, who hoped to spare her clients the stress she felt when there was simply no blood to be found. No owner should ever have to go through that, she said. Next, we'll move on to USAtoday.com. An article by Claire Thornton titled, How Much Water Should a Cat Drink? It really depends, vets say. As we try to stay hydrated this summer, it's important to make sure our pets are drinking enough water too, which can be sometimes more tricky with cats. Our feline friends don't drink very much water, and it can be hard to tell how much they've consumed just by looking at the water bowl. Cats are not as eager drinkers as dogs, so if you have a dog and a cat, you might worry that your cat's not drinking enough water compared to your dog, says Lori Millward, a professor at Ohio State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. The smaller the cat or kitten, the less water they need. A small 6-pound cat may only drink about 10 tablespoons of water per day, according to veterinarians. If your cat is eating wet food from a can or pouch, that means it will get less of its daily hydration directly from its water bowl. Signs of dehydration in cats include being more tired than normal and gums that feel dry or sticky, according to Millward. If your cat is drinking too much water, that could be a sign of health problems like diabetes or kidney disease, she said. Here's how you can tell if your cat is consuming the proper amount of water, according to veterinary experts. How much water do cats drink? It depends on how much the cat weighs and whether it eats dry or wet food. So many different things come into play with how much water they actually drink from the water bowl, Millward said. Typically, a cat will consume just over 1.5 tablespoons of water per pound daily, says Natara Luce, a neighborhood veterinarian in Brooklyn, New York. An average 10-pound cat will drink like one cup a day, Luce told USA Today. What if my cat eats wet food? The amount of water a cat drinks from its water bowl will go down if it's eating wet food, Millward said. Wet cat food can contain up to 80% of water, according to Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Cats that eat dry food usually take more of their daily requirement in by drinking, the school says. Remember that if you switch your cat's diet, its water bowl drinking habits will likely change, Millward said. Many times I would have cats that were eating on dry food diet, and then the owner switched them over to canned food diet, and that owner would come in and be really worried that their cat wasn't drinking enough water, Millward said. Do cats drink more water when it's hot? During hot weather like this summer's heat waves, your cat may need to replace their body's water at an increased rate to maintain normal hydration, Millward said. But if your cat is healthy, it will naturally do a good job of maintaining its body temperature, including resting more and consuming more water on its own, she said. Animals are very good at adapting to the changing seasons, Millward said. So even if you don't have air conditioning, your cat's body has likely been acclimating to steadily increasing temperatures throughout the spring and summer. It's always a great idea to offer multiple water bowls through your home, and the most important thing to highlight is just having that fresh, clean water available at all times, Millward said. Keeping your cat's food and water bowls away from the litter box is also highly recommended, she said, because our pets don't want to eat and drink right next to where they go to the bathroom. If you're worried your cat isn't drinking enough from its bowl, tossing a few extra drops of water into their food bowl can't hurt, Millward said. As long as they like the food with the water added, that's not bad, Millward said. But the most important thing is just having the fresh, clean water available on a regular basis. Next, we'll move on to the Cornell Dog Watch, which is expert information from the Cornell Richard P. Riney Canine Health Center. We'll read an article written by Brad Burrington, DVM, who is a small animal practitioner in Vermont and one of the first members of the Veterinary Virtual Care Association. So this article is titled, Make Telemed Work for You. An accurate history, video, and or photos can help make a virtual veterinary visit work for your dog. Telemedicine isn't really new. It has a long history. In an article on the National Library of Medicine website, Thomas Nesbitt, MD, from the University of California at Davis, referenced an article in The Lancet from 1879 that discussed using the telephone to reduce unnecessary office visits. And a cover story in a 1925 edition of Science and Invention magazine showed a doctor diagnosing a patient by radio, envisioning a device that would allow for the video examination of a patient over distance, wrote Dr. Nesbitt. We're living that now, and it's a valuable option. Admittedly, veterinary telemedicine gained popularity and notoriety due to COVID-19 in 2020. Remember how difficult it was to get a veterinary appointment during the pandemic? And once you got there, you had to stay in your vehicle while your pet was taken inside, usually speaking with your veterinarian only over the phone. How nice would it have been if this could have all been done in your own home? Veterinary telemedicines have already taken off in parts of Canada and Europe prior to COVID, says Dr. Brad Barrington, a 1987 graduate of Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine, and one of the first members of the Veterinary Virtual Care Association, which was founded in 2020. Note, the Virtual Veterinary Care Association, VVCA.org, helps practitioners understand the laws surrounding care. During the pandemic, pet ownership skyrocketed and staff shortages abounded in the United States. As a result, the demand for veterinary services far exceeded the industry's ability to meet veterinary needs in a timely fashion. Telemedicine enabled veterinary teams to provide quality care for more pets, some of whom may have otherwise have received delayed care or no care at all. In-person visits still important. Telemedicine is not a replacement for in-person veterinary visits, but rather an extension of them. Implemented properly, telemedicine expands the reach of the veterinarian, potentially helping people with pets in remote areas whose access to in-person veterinary care is geographically limited. Implemented properly, telemedicine ensures the welfare of the animal without diminishing the integrity of the veterinary profession. There are rules that apply to telemedicine, however, that both the pet owner and the veterinary provider must abide by. The most important is the veterinary-client-patient relationship, VCPR. The current stance of the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and the American Veterinary Medical Association, AVMA, is that a VCPR cannot be established solely by telephone or other electronic means. This means that to provide telemedicine services, your veterinarian needs to have seen and examined your pet in person within a reasonable time frame to establish and maintain a current VCPR. This is currently quite a hot topic, however. The rules pertaining to the establishment of the VCPR differ from state to state, and those rules are rapidly changing, says Dr. Burrington. States that have previously had an outright ban on any prescribing without physically touching a pet now allow treatment to be performed after establishing a virtual VCPR. Treatment versus guidance. An established VCPR is especially important when the purpose of the telemedicine visit is to treat a condition, as opposed to just offering guidance. Guidance-oriented telemedicine, called teletriage or teleadvice, is often used to assess the pet's condition and guide the owner on whether an immediate trip to an emergency facility is warranted or if it is probably okay to wait to see a veterinarian in the next day. The goal of treatment-oriented telemedicine, on the other hand, is to assess, diagnose, and treat conditions. Your veterinarian may provide telemedicine services simply via FaceTime or Zoom, or she or he may use an app specifically designed to facilitate veterinary telemedicine. These apps often integrate history questions that can be added to the medical record, a location to upload previous medical records, pictures or videos, a scheduling portal, and if indicated, a method for prescribing, says Dr. Burrington. All of the data is maintained in a medical record so that the system can comply with state regulations for that important tenet in the Practice Act of each state. Owner preparation. When considering a veterinary telemedicine visit, be prepared and know what your goals are. If all you need is advice, this can be done over the phone or in a text chat, says Dr. Burrington. If you're hoping for treatment, a video call is needed. Having a good high-speed connection is extremely helpful. Note, you can use free online testing sites found by searching internet speed tests to check your connection and bandwidth ahead of time. Generally, bandwidth of at least 10 Mbps, screen level resolution of at least 640 by 360, and a video speed of at least 30 frames per second are recommended. Before the visit, get set up with your pet in a quiet, well-lit area with no backlighting and where interruptions are unlikely. Be prepared to pay for the call and to answer questions regarding your pet's medical history, both for the current problem and any other medical issues your pet has had in the past. Have a handy list of any prior diagnoses and all medications your pet currently takes. If your dog has something wrong that is visual, e.g. skin disease, take some well-focused digital photos to share. Make sure your pet can't get up and leave the visit. The telemedicine provider will have difficulty making an assessment while watching a high-speed chase around your house, says Dr. Burrington. If medical therapy is warranted, you should have an idea of where your preferred pharmacy is located. Some telemedicine providers will have their own pharmacy, but you can request prescriptions be sent to your location. Telemedicine offers an avenue to increase to on-demand quality veterinary care for pet owners. As this practice continues to grow, more pets can receive the care that they need when they need it. This should be considered a win-win for all. I think we will see how large increases in the use of veterinary telemedicine, says Dr. Burrington. Telemedicine will cater to two different markets in particular, those looking for a more affordable option than brick-and-mortar care with a higher, its higher price point, and those looking for a more convenient option. Sidebar, what telemed can do. Teleadvice is frequently sought for incidents involving accidental ingestions and injuries, but it can be an option for many other problems, including gastrointestinal disorders, dermatological conditions, urinary problems, lethargy, aggressive dogs, geriatric, arthritic dogs. And then a quick this just in. Dog entry to the U.S. New regs increase paperwork. The Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, issued new regulations to control the entry of dogs into the United States from other countries, effective August 1, 2024. These rules are for disease control and apply to all dogs, including puppies, service animals, and dogs that left the United States and are returning. They also apply whether you're a U.S. citizen, legal U.S. resident, or foreign national. The CDC developed DogBot to help you wade through the regulations that affect your individual dog. That you can find that at www.cdc.gov/importation/bringing-and-animal-into-the-united-states/dogs.html. In general, the dogs must be at least 6 months of age at the time of entry, have an implanted International Organization for Standardization, ISO, compatible microchip prior to the required rabies vaccination, appear healthy upon arrival, have a CDC dog import form receipt and photograph of the dog within 10 days if the dog is under 1 year old. Additional documentation may be required, so you need to check out the CDC's DogBot. If the rules are not followed, entry of the dog will not be allowed and the dog will be returned to the last country of departure at your expense. We've run out of time for today's episode of All About Pets. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. All About Pets is available at a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.